VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And welcome to Crosstalk here on VCY America. Well, today, February 12th, is the birthday of President Abraham Lincoln. Born in 1809, served as the 16th President of the United States from March of 1861 until his assassination in April of 1865. And next week, February 22nd, is the birthday of George Washington. Born in 1732, served as our first President of the United States from 1789 to 1797. Ladies and gentlemen, many of the contributions of these men have been swallowed up by what is now known as President's Day that occurs next Monday and calls attention to all the presidents of the United States. But today we're going to pause and take a specific look at the specific impact of both Washington and Lincoln. Joining us, we welcome back to Crosstalk William Federer. He's a nationally known speaker, author, and president of Amerisearch Incorporated. It's a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. He has authored many, many books, including America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, The Original 13, History of Religion in America's First 13 States, Who is the King in America, For God and Country, a handbook for the statesman citizen, and he's also the speaker on the American Minute Daily Broadcast. Bill, nice to have you back on Crosstalk.
Jim, great to be with you.
Well, as you know, today is the birthday of Abraham Lincoln, and I'd like you to begin with him first. We'll cover Washington in another segment. And I know you have a lot you can share about the significant impact that came from his life. And we note that today is also the birthday. As a matter of fact, Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln were born on the exact same day, but their lives had totally opposite effects. And we did spend some time last week with Ken Ham talking about Charles Darwin and Darwin Day and Evolution Sunday this past weekend. But Bill, help us to learn about Abraham Lincoln and some of the certainly he had a totally different impact than we got from Charles Darwin, did we not?
Right. Lincoln is best known for issuing the Emancipation Proclamation and for freeing millions of slaves, claiming that all men are created equal. As he stated in his Gettysburg Address, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Darwin's theory of evolution, though, claims that all men are not equal, that some are more evolved than others. And he comes up with this elaborate description of the survival of the fittest. Well, lo and behold, that influenced Karl Marx and Hegel and the dialectic conflict. And Darwin even wrote, Karl Marx wrote that Darwin's book is very important and serves me as a basis in natural selection and class struggles. And of course, even Margaret Sanger was influenced by Darwin, and even Stalin and all of the different dictators. Well, Lincoln's last act in office was to put the phrase, "In God We Trust," on our national coins. And so here he reaffirmed belief in God. Darwin's theory has been used to undermine a creator God, and it's been spreading atheism all around. One of the quotes Lincoln told his cabinet, he said, "The time for the enunciation of the emancipation policy can no longer be delayed. Public sentiment will sustain it. Many of my warmest friends and supporters demand it, and I have promised God that I will do it." Well, when Secretary Salmon Chase asked Lincoln about his statement, Lincoln replied, "I made a solemn vow before God that if General Lee were driven back from Pennsylvania after the Battle of Gettysburg, I would crown the result by the declaration of freedom to the slaves." And here's a couple of quotes from Lincoln, the first Republican president. He said, "Whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on him personally." Another statement, he says, "It is difficult to make a man miserable when he feels he is worthy of himself and claims kindred to the great God who made him." And again, referring to all men are made in the image of God. And then Lincoln said, "This is a world of compensation. He who would be no slave must consent to have no slave. Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under a just God cannot long retain it." These are just some of the fascinating inspiring statements by Lincoln. And now, one of the things often overlooked was the role of taxes in the beginning of the Civil War. And we had no income tax. The federal government was supported by tariff taxes on imports, and the taxes made the imports more expensive. Well, this helped the northern factories to have a sort of a market cushion, but the South didn't have very many factories. And so the tariffs made the European goods more expensive, or they had to buy the more expensive goods from the North. Prior to the Civil War, at one point, 90% of the federal budget was paid by the South collecting tariff taxes. And they refused several different times, and then was the threat to secede and so forth, and the war began. And so that's one important thing. It was not until a year and a half into the war that Lincoln did issue the Emancipation Proclamation, changing the focus of the war from tariffs and the states breaking away to slavery. And this was a brilliant move politically. It's called gaining the moral high ground, because no one wanted to be seen as defending slavery. And so all of the European support for the Confederacy immediately dried up. William Wilberforce had gotten the slavery out of England. And so when the Confederate states were viewed as pro-slavery rather than against the federal government, the European support dried up. So that's one important thing. Another was that the cotton crop was decimated, and so the South didn't have any money, and so they were having to pay tariffs with less money. And but I don't want to get too much off track because we're talking about Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
So Lincoln was a politician, and he knew how to use the different he tried the Emancipation Proclamation, which, in all honesty, was an overstretch. He had no authority to free the slaves, and he was called on it. And so he had to backtrack and say, okay, we're going to free the slaves through passing the 13th Amendment. And so that was the whole movie that Steven Spielberg put together about Lincoln needing to get enough votes to get this passed. And it did pass, and he signed it. The president did not have to sign it, but he did sign it, meaning that he was really behind the 13th Amendment. And one other thing it's important to bring up is the views on slavery. You had the radical Republican North, which sort of was birthed out of the Second Great Awakening revival. And they said, slavery's wrong, free the slaves now. You had the moderate, rhino, deep state type of North, and they were the Republicans that were establishment. They said, slavery's wrong, but we got to live with it. It's been here, you know, just was gradually get out of slavery. And then you had the moderate neutral that really didn't care about social issues. They just cared about taxes and tariffs and so forth. Then you had the moderate Democrat South that said, slavery's been here for centuries, just treat your slave nice. And then you had the extreme Democrat South that said, slavery's good, let's expand it to these new territories coming into the Union, like Kansas, right, bleeding Kansas. Let's force the North, who are against slavery, to have to participate in it through the fugitive slave law, which is if a slave escaped to the North and you knew that your neighbor was helping them get to Canada, you had to snitch on your neighbor. Otherwise, you were guilty of a federal crime. And so this forced the North to have to dip their hands in the evil blood of the slave trade. So you have these five categories. Interestingly, Ronald Reagan gave a quote. He said, Lincoln recognized we could not survive as a free nation when some men could decide that others were not fit to be free but should be slaves.
Hmm.
Likewise, we cannot survive today when some men decide others should be aborted and not live.
Mm-hmm.
And so Reagan made the connection between slavery during Lincoln's time and abortion during our time.
You know, Bill, there is another aspect I'd like you to comment on that Lincoln is often known for, and it's when he appointed this National Fast Day, and you know that phrase that just howls out of that address is when he had talked about how we have forgotten God as a nation. We have all these bounties, but we've forgotten God. This is a very significant aspect from his presidency, too, isn't it?
Right. As I mentioned, he is the one who put Ngabo Trust on our coins.
Right.
He's the one who instituted an annual day of Thanksgiving. And twice during the Civil War, he had days of fasting. And in an era that we live in today, it's almost impossible for people to conceive a president declaring a day of fasting, although I think it's a good idea. So Lincoln said, the Senate of the United States, devoutly recognizing the supreme authority and just government of Almighty God in all the affairs of men and nations, has by resolution requested the president to designate and set apart a day of prayer and humiliation and fasting. And then he goes on, where it is the duty of all nations as well as men to owe their dependence on the overruling power of God, confess their sins and transgressions. I'm just going to pause there. The presidents throughout history declared days of prayer and fasting. It was Adams during a threatened war with France had a day of fasting. James Madison, when the British burned the White House, had a day of fasting. William Henry Harrison died in office, and then John Tyler took over as the first vice president to become president. He declared a day of fasting. During the cholera epidemic, Zachary Taylor, the president, declared a day of fasting. Of course, 150,000 Americans died, and he made it August of 1849. By the end of the month, the death rates dropped off, and the cholera epidemic ended. And even Woodrow Wilson during World War I had a day of fasting and prayer. But if you read these, they all talk about confessing our sins and transgressions. Mm-hmm. Why is that? They understood that God cannot bless sin. It's like two magnets that are stuck together, and one of them turns the opposite direction. The first one wants to touch, but the second one is wants to get away. They're just not going to touch. And the founders and Lincoln realized that we have to first repent of our sins, and then God can bless us. And then the magnet sort of flips around. And so a couple lines out of that, he said, we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand that preserved us in peace, multiplied, enriched and strengthened us. We vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we've become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. He goes on that we should confess our national sins and pray for clemency and forgiveness. So again, this is Lincoln. His face is on every penny and every $5 bill. And he said that we should repent of our sins. He even said that they abstain on that day from their secular pursuits. So he's saying, okay, the spiritual is superior to the secular. Again, that would be an anomaly today, but this is Lincoln. And it's important for us to remember this. Lincoln did something, especially in his second inaugural address. He connected sin and judgment. He said, if every drop of blood drawn by the bondsman's whip should be repaid by a drop of blood drawn by the sword, let it be said the judgments of the Lord are altogether true and righteous. He connected the sin with the judgment. Is there anybody today connecting the judgment on our country with the sin of abortion?
Wow.
And in Deuteronomy 28, God judges his people by letting the stranger come in and rise up above them.
Bill Federer, our guest today here on Crosstalk. We're talking about the impact of Washington and Lincoln. We'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Crosstalk.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, popular creation speaker and author with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, this might seem simple, but where did music come from?
Chris, music is an integral part of being in the image of God. The early chapters of Genesis reveal that just within a few generations of creation, men were constructing musical instruments, both wind instruments and string instruments. Soon we see that even this was perverted. Lamech, one of the patriarchs, even sang a song boasting of his adventures and murderous prowess. Musical instruments have been found from soon after the flood. Even Neanderthal fossils are found in conjunction with musical instruments. You see, Chris, the evidence that we find supports the biblical truth of creation. Even music started back in Genesis.
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called That's a Fact. Visit our web store at icr.org/store and use the promo code FACT at the checkout when ordering your That's a Fact DVD.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America, and just taking time to pause and remember the impact of Abraham Lincoln. Today, February 12th, is the birthday of President Abraham Lincoln. Next Thursday is the president of George Washington, the first president of the United States. And Bill Federer is with us today talking about the impact of Washington and Lincoln. And Bill, this last fall, I was able to visit Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington, and went through his house, learned a lot about his background, learned about his leadership, learned about his courage. We participated in a wreath-laying ceremony at his gravesite. We also went through the museum there, and I saw something on display there that was very interesting to me. Many people, I guess, would have been had their stomach turned, but it was the dentures of George Washington on display. And no, they weren't made out of wood, as legend states. But as I stared at those teeth, Bill, I thought, what a story they would have to tell about this man and the many issues he faced in his presidency, and in the Revolutionary War, and the crossing of the Delaware, and the bid to be president, and all that was going on. I thought, what a story they could share with us. Now, those teeth are no longer able to talk, but Bill, I know I could wind you up and you could go for hours about George Washington, his impact and legacy upon this nation, but here in this quarter hour segment, help us better understand this first president of the United States and what really drove him.
Well, you bring up his teeth. He constantly had tooth pain, and so you think of all the stuff that he did, and personally, he was constantly in pain over that. Just amazing. Well, he was unanimously chosen as the Army's Commander-in-Chief. He was unanimously chosen as the President of the Constitutional Convention, where they wrote our U.S. Constitution. And he was unanimously chosen as the first U.S. President twice. And so his relatives all go back to England, obviously. So his great-great-grandfather was a Anglican minister, Reverend Lawrence Washington. But when the Puritans took over England, he lost his job. Well, his son is John Washington. He's a merchant, and he came to America, actually was on a boat that sank in the Potomac River, and he had to climb out. And anyway, then he stayed. And so there's a local Anglican church that was renamed Washington in the honor of John. Grandfather Lawrence, who was Anglican, and then his father Augustine, who was a vestryman, sort of like a deacon in the Anglican church. His dad dies when he's 11 years old. George, his favorite brother is his older half brother Lawrence, who's in the British Navy. And he actually fought to capture Panama from Spain, right? George Washington's older brother fights with Admiral Edward Vernon to capture Portobello, Panama from Spain in 1739. And so his older half-brother Lawrence comes back and names his estate Mount Vernon after his Admiral Edward Vernon. And Lawrence then gets ill and has to go to Barbados, the doctor's orders, to try to recover. And George goes with him, and George catches smallpox. And he's suffers that, but he recovers. Why is that important? During the Revolutionary War, more soldiers died of smallpox than died in battle. But since Washington had it, he was immune, so he could ride back and forth through his troops and keep in charge of the country during all this. Well, when the older brother Lawrence finally does die, his wife gets the farm, but then she remarries into the Fairfax family, and he was the largest landowner in Virginia. And so George inherits his older brother's farm, and he's just in his early 20s. He ends up marrying a widow, Mary Ball Washington, and she's just 26. And they never have kids. She has two kids. One is 16 years old when she dies of an epileptic seizure in George Washington's arms after dinner. You know, she has her fit, epileptic fit, and he's holding her while she dies. And he said it really broke their heart. The other was a son, and he ended up becoming an aide de camp to Washington. And he died at the Battle of Yorktown of camp fever. So here's the Battle of Yorktown where we win the Revolution. And Washington's own wife's son dies. Well, Washington felt bad that he never adopted him. And so he adopts the two grandkids of his wife. And one of those ends up George Washington Parke Custis is the one who owned the Mount Vernon. I'm sorry, the Arlington Cemetery used to be his farm.
Hmm.
And don't want to get too far off track. So George fights in the Battle of Monongahela during the French and Indian War. So the two biggest powers on the planet were the British Empire and the French Empire. The French had, you know, King Louis the 14th, the Sun King, and then it's Louis the 15th, and then the Revolution takes place during the time of Louis the 16th. And then you have the British, and you have King George the 2nd during the War of 1812. I'm sorry, the French and Indian War, and then George the 3rd. Now, so George is fighting under Edward Braddock, and he's the commander of the British forces in America. George Washington is a colonel. In the year is 1755. They're ambushed. 900 British out of the 1,400 die, and the rivers are running with blood. And Washington writes that he had two horses shot under him, four bullet holes through his coat, but he was unharmed. Matter of fact, Daniel Boone actually fought in that same battle for the British, and he survived as well. And so now he has experience fighting with the British, and there's a series of letters where he's writing the Virginia governor, asking for chaplains and, for his soldiers. And the governor writes back and says, I don't have time to get around to it. Washington writes back and says, hey, we really need them. The governor says later. And then Washington says, hey, I went ahead and appointed somebody. And then the governor says, you've usurped your authority. And anyway, so when Washington becomes the commander of the Continental Army, what does he do? He asks for chaplains. And so after the Declaration of Independence is read to his troops, the first thing he does is appoint chaplains to every regiment.
Huh.
And he says, the general hopes and trusts that every officer and man will endeavor to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier. Another place at Valley Forge, he says, to the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to laud the more distinguished character of Christian. Some Delaware Indian chiefs bring some youths to be trained in American schools. Washington tells them, you do well to wish to learn our arts and way of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. And Washington gives really strict orders. There's no gaming or games of chance or gambling amongst the troops. And he forbids swearing and cursing. And he even drums out of camp someone accused of attempting to commit sodomy with the service of infamy in 1778. And he assembles the entire army and they drum him out with infamy.
Hmm.
So, and then he gives an address. This is July 2nd of 1776. And it's very inspiring. He says, the time is now near at hand, which must probably determine whether Americans are to be freemen or slaves, whether they are to have property they can call their own, whether their houses and farms are be pillaged and destroyed and themselves consigned to a state of wretchedness from which no human efforts will deliver them. The fate of unborn millions will now depend under God on the courage and conduct of this army. So he thought about the unborn millions. He said, our cruel and unrelenting enemy leaves us no choice but a brave resistance or the most abject submission. We have therefore to resolve to conquer or die. And so that was the determination that Washington had, that we, who were the unborn, were benefiting from this. Why is this significant? The King of England was the head. He was a globalist. He controlled the largest empire the planet Earth had ever seen. All of India, a quarter of the world's population right there, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guiana, Canada, and America. And Washington helped give us a government where the people are the king. And I love the story where after the war, a painter named Benjamin West is in England, and he's painting a portrait of King George III and making conversation, because it takes a long time to paint these portraits. The king says, What do they say that this Washington will do now that he has defeated the king's army? And Benjamin West said, they say, Your Highness, that he's going to return to his farm. The king said, if he does that, he truly will be the greatest man in the world.
Well,
you see, kings killed to get power, kings killed to keep power. Washington had the power, and he's going to give it up and go back to his farm. And so Robert Frost, who was a poet, said, I often say of George Washington that he was one of the few men in the whole history of the world who was not carried away by power. And so just a fascinating man that, matter of fact, the founders started an order of Cincinnatus. Who was that? Well, there was a Roman Republic. Now, this is before Julius Caesar made himself dictator for life. But during the Roman Republic period, from about 500 B.C. up to around 45 B.C., they had senators, 600 senators. And when they were attacked, they would have one person be in charge, sort of like dictator for a year. And they picked this farmer named Cincinnatus, and he was really good. He defeated the enemy. After defeating them, he goes back to his farm, and it goes back to the Roman Republic. When he's 80 years old, they get him to fight another one. He takes over. He's in command of the entire Roman Republic. Afterwards, he goes back to his farm. And so America's founders looked to that as the example. And so they started this Order of Cincinnatus. It's a noble thing to give up the power.
Yeah.
And Washington set that example. And then, of course, after having been president for two terms, he decides that's it and goes back again to Mount Vernon, which every president followed that example of only serving two terms until FDR got himself elected four times. And then they passed the 22nd Amendment, limiting a president to two terms. And so, again, Washington said that the sword is the last thing to pick up and the first thing to put down. One of the other stories is the Newburgh conspiracy. The soldiers hadn't been paid for a couple of years. And so understandably, here they are risking their lives, abandoning their family and farms, and they're fighting, and they're not being paid. You know, Robert Morris is trying to borrow money to pay him a little bit. Well, during this time, they march toward Washington, New York City. That's where the Capitol was. And they're planning on just taking over and saying, okay, we're going to just set up our own dictatorship because we haven't been paid. Washington hears about it, and he shows up at their planning meeting unannounced, and he walks in the room, and the room gets quiet, and he pulls out his spectacles, his glasses, and he puts them on, and many of the soldiers had never seen him wearing glasses before, and Washington says, excuse me while I put these on, I've grown blind in the service of my country. And then he reads, we fought for so much, and should we, you know, throw it all away? And then he folds it up, puts it back into his pocket, and he leaves. And there was not a dry eye in the place, and everybody just sort of quietly left, and the Newburgh conspiracy dissipated. So he could have assumed the head of the army and made himself king, but instead he showed this quality that has forever been a standard of leadership in the country. Of not lusting for power.
Yeah, and what an example that is, and how far we have strayed from an attitude like what we saw displayed from George Washington. We're up against a break, and we are talking with Bill Federer today here on Crosstalk, and if you have a question you'd like to ask about Washington or about Lincoln, as we are paying tribute today, today is the birth date of Abraham Lincoln, next week the birth date of George Washington. We're talking about the impact of Washington and Lincoln, and if you have a specific question about either Washington or Lincoln, feel free to give us a call here, 800-733-9829. That's 800-733-9829. We'll be back in 1 minute. This is Crosstalk.
Is it important that we be aware of the signs of the times? Do Christians agree about the role of America in Bible prophecy? Is there a biblical evidence that the church will escape the tribulation period? Will only believers enter into Christ's millennial kingdom? These are just a few of the many questions addressed in the Bible Prophecy Answer Book by Ron Rhodes. Whether you're looking for quick instruction or you're eager to go deeper, this book will help you navigate prophetic scripture passages to better understand matters of eternal significance. Learn about Israel's rebirth, the Ezekiel invasion, the rapture, the judgment seat of Christ, the Antichrist, Armageddon, the Great White Throne Judgment, and so much more. VCY is offering the Bible Prophecy Answer Book for a donation of $16 or two copies for a donation of $25 when you call 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. William Federer is our guest here today, his website, AmericanMinute.com. Bill, I know you've got a number of resources there on your site. You've got books, you've got DVDs, you've got downloads, you've got all kinds of info that our listeners can take available, you know, the resources you have. But give us a moment here about your AmericanMinute.com.
Right. Well, I sent out a daily email of something that happened on each date in history, and a lot of homeschoolers use it, a lot of people interested in history. It sort of takes little bite-sized doses of what I talk about and puts it there with pictures and so forth. And also there's about 20 different books that I've written along with a DVD series that people can avail themselves of at AmericanMinute.com.
Okay, and write it down, folks. Again, if you have a question today you would like to ask, as we're paying tribute today to two presidents, the first president and the 16th president, whose birthdays are being observed, we certainly welcome your calls here to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829, 800-733-9829, talking about the impact of Washington, the impact of Lincoln. And, Bill, before we take calls, though, I think it would be good to look at a very significant address that was given by George Washington, President Washington, known as his farewell address.
Right. Well, the big fear was that we were going to return to a centralized government with a king. And if you've ever worn a hat for a long time and you take it off and you still sort of feel that hat on there, well, the country had been so used to having the restrictions of a king. And you have to face it, the most efficient form of government is a monarchy. One person says it, it happens, or heads roll. And our government was actually designed to be inefficient on purpose, slow to making good decisions, but thank God, slow to making irreversible bad decisions. It could take a lifetime to build a mansion and one irresponsible match to burn the thing down in a day. Jefferson was ambassador to France when they wrote the Constitution. He comes back. He's having tea with George Washington. And Jefferson's complaining about the bicameral legislature, a House and a Senate. And Jefferson's saying, it's going to take forever to get things done. Washington said, you just demonstrated the brilliance of it. And Jefferson said, how? Washington said, you poured your scalding hot tea into your saucer to cool it, and then you poured it back from the saucer into your cup. In the same way, we want legislation to go from one house to the other to back and forth until it cools down and nothing is passed in the passion of the moment.
Hmm.
In other words, the last thing they wanted was to say, we have to hurry up and pass this thing so we can find out what's in it.
Yeah.
And so the fear was concentrated power, but Washington in his farewell address gives a warning. He says, disorders and miseries will gradually incline the minds of men to seek security in the absolute power of an individual who turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. And he says, the spirit of encroachment tends to consolidate the powers of all departments in one, and thus to create, whatever the form of government, a despotism. Now, a despot is someone with absolute and arbitrary power. Absolute means the moment they say it, it's the law. Arbitrary means you don't know what they're going to say next. And so Washington says, let there be no change by usurpation. Though, in one instance, this may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. What's he talking about? Well, it was good that Lincoln ended slavery. But in the process, a lot of rights went from the states to the federal government. It was good that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to get us through the Depression. But in the process, a lot of rights were usurped by the federal government and his New Deal programs. It was good that LBJ wanted to end poverty. But in the process, a whole lot of rights were usurped by the federal government and the welfare state. It was good that President Bush wanted to make sure there's no more terrorist attacks. But the federal government usurped a whole lot of power and passed the NSA and the Patriot Act and surveillance. Now they can read every one of your emails. And President Obama, He claimed to want to do good with his Obamacare, but in the process, a whole lot of rights were usurped away from the states and away from the people. And he said, I don't have time to wait for Congress. I have my pen and my phone. And so we see that Washington's warning was that there's going to be crises, and in the crises, there are going to be people that come along that are going to want to promise to fix things. They just need a little more power to do it. He goes, that's the danger, because he goes on, whatever temporary good is gained from this usurpation of power, it does permanent damage to our free government.
Wow, much to learn here, folks. Let's go to the phone lines. Kathy is calling from Oshkosh. Kathy, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Bill, I would like to ask if you know how much of any of this information about our founding fathers and Lincoln and Washington is still being taught in our public schools today, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you, Kathy.
Well, unfortunately, most schools, they've embraced a revisionism. And this is a communist tactic. It's actually called deconstruction, where you separate a people from their past, get them into a neutral where they do not remember where they came from, and then you can brainwash them into the future you have planned for them. Sort of like a gene therapy for a culture. You want to take out the old identity and put in a new. It's a sales technique. If I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I would do is say negative things about the toothpaste you are currently using. You're still using that old stuff? Don't you know it'll eat the enamel off your teeth? Ooh, you're repulsed by it. Now I got you into a neutral position. You're sort of open-minded. What are all the toothpaste out there nowadays? And then I can give you my pitch for this brand-new tartar-controlled breath freshener stuff. And so they go into the classrooms, and they tell the kids negative things about the founders. They took land from Indians, sold people into slavery. They were chauvinists, and ooh, the students are repulsed by them. Now you got the kids into a neutral. They're sort of open-minded. What are all the belief systems out there nowadays? And then you can give them your pitch for socialism or LGBT or Islam, right? Hmm. Europe went through this. Europe went from a Judeo-Christian past, right? Catholic cathedrals, Protestant Reformation, Jewish neighborhoods. Then Europe went into the French Revolution and Robespierre and the secularism and Napoleon spreading all this secularism around Europe. And Europe becomes secular. And then it's, hey, anything goes, bring in all these new beliefs in free sex and gay and LGBT. But now Europe is becoming Islamic.
Yeah.
And Mohammed is the number one name for newborns in London, Milan, Brussels, in Germany. And so we see that the trend is from drive neutral to reverse, from Judeo-Christian to secular gay to Islamic. And so the whole gay agenda is simply a transition phase. It's a creative way to cut ties with the Christian past, but it's quickly co-opted by Islam. And so what we see in a lot of these schools, that for the longest period of time, Christians have pulled back and gotten out, and the textbook companies have been bought by not only seculars, but wealthy Muslims. And now they've got chapters. I've seen some of these books. They'll say that they'll have chapters on religion, little paragraph on Jews, maybe two or three paragraphs on Christianity, but they'll end it by saying, Jesus was accused of being a troublemaker and executed, period. And then it goes on, five chapters on Islam, Muhammad was great, and he was the prophet of Allah and all this and that. This is what is being taught. These kids are learning the five pillars of Islam, and they're being brainwashed, basically. And why? Because wealthy Muslims have bought the textbook companies, and they've given money to politicians who need money, and they're voting the way that we'll get these put into the schools. And people are not just now waking up. How come they can't teach John 3:16 to these kids?
Mm-hmm.
How come they can't teach them? Oh, that's separation of church and state. But yet they can have prayer rooms and rugs and so forth. Colorado school had the students saying the pledge, one nation under Allah. In Tennessee, they have middle schools with little kids in prayer rugs, and the teachers are teaching them how to bow toward, you know, Mecca and so forth. So we've been pulling out, and it's important for us to rediscover that our founders, for all their faults, they gave us a form of government where we get to be in charge, where we're the king.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, and VCY does have that book, Who is the King in America? We've made available. You can always contact our switchboard, or it's online here at vcyamerica.org, or by calling 800-729-9829. Both the book and DVD, and has made a huge, huge difference in understanding history past. Brad in West Dallas, you're on the air.
Brother Jim, your guest mentioned that President Lincoln, when he freed the slaves, he was told that he didn't have the power to do that. Well, what he should have said in response was that the Supreme Court did not have the power to declare blacks as non-citizens and as property in the Dred Scott decision, because they didn't have the power to do that either. Plus, they had to talk stupid to do it. They said their cheap excuse was that blacks were not considered citizens when the Constitution was passed in 1787. But that's false. There were free blacks up north, and they were U.S. citizens at the same time the Constitution was drafted. So they had to lie in order to declare blacks as property.
Thank you, Brad. Bill, any comment?
Yeah, that's a perfect illustration. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Dred Scott case, 1857, declared that slaves were property. And so here's Lincoln, in his first inaugural address, said, if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court the instant they are made, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. And so when we have the Supreme Court declaring gay marriage, the Supreme Court, you know, declaring abortion, we have a precedent of Lincoln saying the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott case made a wrong decision. And he goes on to say that the people of this country are the rightful masters of both Congresses and courts. And so the Supreme Court is not the final authority. We, the people, are the final authority. I tell people a little illustration. Imagine a king going into his castle, and the janitor says, sorry, king, you can't go in this part of the castle anymore. And you're like, who are you to tell me? Oh, I'm the janitor. I was appointed by the cook and the butler. Well, they're my servants. I hired them. And so here in America, we have the Supreme Court saying, okay, country from now on, there's no more male and female marriage. And it's like, well, who are you to tell us? Well, I was appointed by the president and the Senate. Well, I vote in the president and the Senate. We, the people, vote in. So the Supreme Court justices are servants of the servants, so forth. We have to regain our authority in this country.
Let's go to Kevin calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question. See, I was born on February 22nd, on George Washington's birthday. Then it says that he was born February 22nd, 1732. But then I look at a website, and it says that he was born on February 11th, 1731. So was he really born February 11th?
Well, that's a fun question. It goes back to Julius Caesar. When he became the Roman emperor, he took all the calendars that was in these different countries that were based on the moon, and he came up with a brand new calendar based on the sun. And it's called a solar calendar, or the Julian calendar, after Julius Caesar. He moves the beginning of the year from March 1st to January 1st, and he has a leap year every 4 years. And that was used for nearly 1,500 years. But what happened was that it was a little bit off by 11 minutes a year. Doesn't sound like a lot, but by the 1500s, that turned into 10 days off. And so there was a pope named Gregory, and he comes up with a Gregorian calendar, and he basically there's a leap year every 4 years, except the year is divisible by 100 unless they're divisible by 400. A little bit complicated, but it's so accurate that it's the same calendar we're using today. And so the English countries were Protestant, and so they did not adopt the Catholic calendar until 1754. And when they did, there was a 10 days disappeared from like...
Tell you what, we're going to have to finish it up right after the break. Thank you for the question, Kevin. We'll have them finish that response. We'll be back in 1 minute. This is Crosstalk. For the Worldview Weekend Minute, I'm Brennan House. Our website is worldviewtimes.com. Well, I believe Russia is mentioned in the Bible. I also believe China is represented in the Bible. There are many nations listed in the scriptures as part of the last days nations. America, I don't see. What has happened to America? Well, we really don't know, but I do know this. I'm watching Russia and I'm watching China. Do you know these two superpowers have joined forces against America? They're working to undermine the American dollar as the world reserve currency and the petrodollar. Did you know that Brazil,
Russia, India, China, and South America have merged together for a banking system to go against America? Yes, indeed. America seems to be in the crosshairs of Russia and China. Yet many Americans are not watching it. We are, because we understand some potential prophetic implications. For the Worldview Week in Minute, I'm Brandon House.
William Federer is our guest here today on Crosstalk. We're talking about the impact of Washington and Lincoln. Our number is 800-733-9829. And, Bill, we had a charge into the last comments you were making there here as relates to the calendar change that took place. And we'll just have a quick wrap-up that response to the previous caller.
Right. Well, I wrote a whole chapter on this in one of my new books, but England was Protestant and used the old Julian calendar, but Europe was mostly Catholic, and it used the Gregorian calendar. And so there were 10 days difference. And so there are stories of ships leaving England on one day and arriving in Europe at a day earlier, right? And Shakespeare and Miguel de Cervantes, the author of Man of La Mancha, Don Quixote, they died the same day in April of 1623. But when you look at it, 1616. But when you look at it, Miguel de Cervantes died 10 days earlier. But so America, we're British and we're using the Julian calendar. But finally, in 1754, we realized that, hey, the Gregorian calendar, even though it was done by a Catholic pope, it is more accurate. And so they finally switch over and erase 10 days. And so anything prior to 1754, there's two different dates. Usually you'll see an OS for old style or a NS for new style after the date.
Okay. Thank you for that question. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. You're on the air, Mike.
Hey, thanks for setting me up, both of you, for W Heritage and Our Nation of Righteousness and the Gospel. I'd just like to ask about Abraham Lincoln's education so we can all learn from that, the homeschoolers and the public school. Is it true that he came up with a statement, if you learn to read, you can read to learn? God bless you both. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
He was homeschooled, and his parents met at a Second Great Awakening revival meeting. And he's born in Kentucky, but then his mom dies. And the dad more or less goes into town looking for another wife and comes back with another wife. But anyway, George would read along in front of the cabin fireplace. And I would often speak in Springfield, Illinois, and they actually have a trail from the little town where he lived all the way into Springfield to a lawyer's office. And he would walk 30 miles to borrow a law book and then come back and read it. Then he would, you know, go back and return it. How did that happen? Well, he and a friend had a little general store. And it sold a little whiskey on the side, but Lincoln didn't like that part of it, and he wanted to get out of the business. But somebody was coming by going out west for the wagon trains going out west. They didn't have any money. They needed food. They had a barrel full of junk. And they said, look, can we trade this barrel for some food? Lincoln said, okay. Shows that he wasn't a really good businessman, but nevertheless, he's digging through this barrel and finds at the very bottom of it Blackstone's Law Commentary. And he begins to read. And he got fascinated, and that began his homeschooling effort to want to become a lawyer. And he kept reading law books and law books, and then finally apprenticed as a lawyer and then became a state rep in Illinois. They were meeting in a city called Vandalia. And the state capitol was on the first floor, and one of the humorous stories was they needed a quorum before they could vote on things, and they were going to vote on something, and Lincoln and his buddies didn't want to have to vote on it, so they opened the window and they climbed out, and so there was not a quorum. There wasn't enough people there to vote on it. Anyway, that's one of the little humorous stories. But
Let's go to Lawrence, Michigan, and Zoltan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to mention, you know, it's kind of timely, the thing with Lincoln, because the Me Too movement with all the supposedly abused women who were abused by their spouses or by males, In Lincoln's case, he was abused by his wife. He was an abused spouse himself. And the other comment I had was, as far as for being a flawed man, regardless of what he did for the blacks and the Emancipation Proclamation, while that was going on, there was a lot of atrocities and abuse of Native Americans, the Indians, the Indian Wars.
Any comments on that, Bill?
There were a couple thoughts come to mind. First, his health. Lincoln did suffer from depression, and you know what the doctors gave him? Mercury. They would take mercury pills. If you know anything about mercury, it's poison, right? So here he is taking this stuff that's actually, you know, making him worse. That's one thing. The second is, yeah, there were Indian atrocities. You had the Democrats who were in charge of the government. They had an Indian removal policy, just shove them all further west. It was not until Ulysses S. Grant came up with the Republican Indian solution, and that was don't shove them anymore, give them a land, and it was the reservation policy. And then it was, okay, they have land, but then that had its own faults as well. There's one overarching thing, and this has to be laid at the Republicans' feet. It was the big government solution. And so prior to the Civil War, the United States were plural. In other words, you'd read the sentence and it would say the United States are. After the Civil War, it would say the United States is. And so the states began to lose the role that they played. The federal government began to usurp power. Lincoln did the same thing with banks. You had each state had their own banks and lots of little local banks, and they would issue their own currency. Lincoln decided to have a federal currency called the greenback, and he promised that the government would pay everybody back after the war. He didn't know how it was going to happen. Ulysses S. Grant found there was gold in the Rocky Mountains, and he actually used the gold to pay back the debt. And the good part was that Lincoln refused to borrow money from European bankers. There's the whole story of the Rothschilds and these European bankers, and kings from both countries would go to the same bankers and ask for money, and these guys would lend the money, and whoever won would have to pay him back with a lot of interest. Whoever lost, they would get the assets because they didn't pay back.
Wow.
And they were wanting to loan money to Lincoln, and he said, no, we're going to finance this ourselves, and he issues the greenback. He also pushed through the first revenue tax, the first income tax, but that's a whole other story.
Thank you for the call, Zoltan. We're out of time. Bill Fitter is our guest here today, and his website, with a lot of historical resources and writings on so many different issues, AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. Bill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim.
As we learn today more about the impact of Washington and Lincoln as the time of their birthdays has come, and America sets aside a day called President's Day as well. Our time is gone. Thanks for joining us today on Crosstalk.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.